Welcome to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Wednesday, June 7th, 2023. Of course, the website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I participate in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, a contact page, and many other useful and important links. I am on Twitter and Gab at Realist Report, and you can also find me on Telegram at t.me/TheRealistReport. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to and help edit The Barnes Review, a bi-monthly revisionist history magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you are not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all the details. All right, today I'm joined by Tim Kelly, host of the Our Interesting Times and Powers and Principalities podcast. All right, Tim Kelly, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you this evening?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Now, you are the host of Our Interesting Times and also Powers and Principalities, which is a podcast that you host with Joe Atwell on the weekends. I love the work that you do and the guests that you have on the program, and I, of course, highly encourage all listeners here to check out your podcast if they do not already listen to it regularly. I know that I follow you on the Podomatic website, which I think is the main platform where you post all your programs, and I subscribe to the audio RSS feed on my phone, so that way I just get all the shows downloaded directly to my phone when they're released. That's very convenient, easy way to follow what you're doing, and many other podcasts, including mine. I have one on right on my website. You can follow it by RSS. So I just wanted to mention that before we get started. This is, you're a returning guest. I think this is like the fifth or sixth time you've been on, so I'm sure people listening are probably familiar with your work, but it is great. I love all the shows that you do. They're always very interesting, and I always learn something, which is very important.
Thank you.
Well, tonight, I couldn't think of a better guest, really, to talk about the Biden administration's recently released National Strategy to Counter Anti-Semitism, which is the first ever, quote, whole of society and whole of government effort to fight anti-Semitism in all its forms throughout society. Now, it's described as the most ambitious and comprehensive U.S. government-led effort to fight anti-Semitism in American history. And this strategy was developed with some of the largest Jewish organizations operating in the country. And, you know, it's crazy. I mean, we hear all about how America is this white supremacist country, but I don't see too many white nationalists or even white supremacist organizations holding major meetings with the White House to develop national strategies to counter anti-white hatred and bigotry, do you?
No, you don't see much of that. You do have meetings at the White House of various Jewish organizations strategizing. And I guess that's an anti-Semitic trope to say that Jews organize and meet.
To even mention that.
To even mention the reality of it. It's a question of definition. What do they mean by these terms, like anti-Semitism or white supremacy, if you will? If you mean white supremacy, sort of a system of privilege and preference for ethnic white Americans, obviously doesn't exist. But if you mean sort of the vestiges or remnants of, you know, America, constitutional law, rule of law, the culture, which then, okay, maybe. But yeah, it is a question of definition, because their idea of anti-Semitism, their definitions of anti-Semitism are ever-changing. Their definitions of white supremacy are ever-changing.
Right.
And so, you know, that, and they prefer it to be that way, because that way they can pretty much use those terms as weapons or terms of abuse to stifle criticism or political opposition. This is what this latest announcement is all about. It's there to preempt or stifle brewing criticism of obvious, inordinate or disproportionate Jewish power in our society, both
right.
Economic, cultural, political. And the fact that the White House would feel compelled to announce a national strategy to combat anti-Semitism in itself is proof that obviously that Jews as a group enjoy inordinate, disproportionate power in our society.
Indeed, and I would even say privilege. I mean, you don't see other groups, you know, coordinating with the highest branches of the federal government to develop strategies to basically shut down anybody, not even necessarily saying anything critical about, you know, one particular group, but even stating basic facts, because that's, I mean, that's really at the end of the day what the ADL wants to shut down, groups like the ADL. And the ADL, by the way, played a key role in developing this national strategy to counter anti-Semitism, which we'll talk about here as we proceed. But it's just, I mean, literally, that's what this is about. It is literally about shutting down any just scholarly recognition and noticing of Jewish power and influence in society, what they've been up to historically, and, you know, what sort of agendas they push in contemporary American society. And I wanted to start by asking you, what's your opinion, like the impetus behind this, the development of the strategy? I mean, I was reading articles going back to, I want to say, like late December, early January, about how Kamala Harris's Jewish husband, the, what do they call him? The second gentleman. I don't know if I want to be called the second gentleman. That's, to me, sort of sounds very, I don't know, sort of insulting and degrading, but the second gentleman, Douglas Emhoff, is this Jewish individual who is very active in the Jewish community, from what I understand, prior to, you know, coming into the White House. You know, he's been very much involved in developing the strategy. He's working with the ADL. He's working with the, what is it, the Conference of Major American Jewish Organizations or something like that. You know, there's all these, there's a million different, you know, organized Jewish groups that are involved in this sort of thing. And professional Jewish ethnic activists who literally get paid a salary, probably, I don't know what Jonathan Greenblatt makes, for example, but these guys are definitely making over six figures, you know, to go out there and actively represent the Jewish community, to advance Jewish interests, to shut down anybody, you know, critical of Jews or exposing Jews or whatever.
And, so, and defend Israel, a foreign state.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. So I'm curious, like the timing of this, the impetus for this strategy. I mean, they were saying how they wanted to release it during Jewish Pride Month. I mean, this month is
Jewish
Gay
American
Pride Month.
Heritage Month, yeah.
Oh, Jewish American Heritage
it
Month.
It is fitting that sort of same American thing. Heritage Month would lead right into Pride Month because you know the Jews are behind all the LGBTQ plus stuff. At least the institutional support for it, you know.
Oh yeah, the normalization of it. I mean, even Joe Biden, frankly, stated that at one point in his career. But I'm curious. I mean, what led to this? I mean, why now? Why were they starting to develop the strategy going back to December and January? Well, January of this year, but December of last year. What was behind this?
Well, I think for several years, because of the between 2005 and say 2016, because of the relatively free environment on the internet, they were losing control of the narrative of many things. And so they had to, quote, shut it down or get control of it. So since 2016, you've had the sort of this purging or deplatforming, normalization of censorship, you know, of a cutting off of financial services. This started with Julian Assange, really, when I think it was Lieberman, Senator Lieberman, who actually thanked, I think, Visa for cutting off payment services to WikiLeaks.
Right. You know, now Lieberman, that guy's a Jew, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Just wanted to point that out.
Of course, WikiLeaks and Assange had not yet to be charged with anything. He's not an American citizen. I still don't understand the legal case against him because he's not a U.S. citizen, and nor is he any different than, say, the Washington Post or the New York Times in publishing information leaked to them. And also, he's not a U.S. citizen, I don't think, right? Yeah, he's not a U.S. citizen. And so you can't even say the treason angle works there because he – you know, and also, yeah, unless you sign an agreement to withhold secrets, even American citizens aren't really obligated to keep secrets, as long as they aren't involved in any illegal activity in like leak in espionage or anything like that. You can spread them around, you can print them and that sort of stuff, disseminate them once you get a hold of them, as long as you're not involved in their illegal, acquisition. Because there is no, unlike Great Britain, there is no Official Secrets Act in the United States. You know, you have to actually sign an agreement of non-disclosure for to get a class, you know, for classified material and security clearances and all that. But that's when it started, I thought. And we've seen, obviously, for several decades, we've been subject to a lot of propaganda and Jewish claims regarding the threats they face and what and the oppression that they face. The obviously the Holocaust narrative feeds into this narrative that Jews must somehow enjoy some sort of special protection in our society, Western society, lest they be subject to another Holocaust or yet another pogrom or something. So that's sort of a self-serving, lachrymose history that the Jews promote, not only amongst themselves, but they leverage it with their control of things like Hollywood and the media. But obviously, this is a theme that's in thousands of movies and thousands. It's a subplot in thousands of movies. We've seen a proliferation of like various Holocaust museums around the country. They call them tolerance museums. You know, museums of tolerance or something. That all spins a narrative. And of course, in recent years, we've seen sort of the in various school districts, the curriculum that is, of course, written by the ADL, sold to various school districts of the ADL about Holocaust education, which is really indoctrination. So
they make money off promoting these narratives even.
Yeah,
it's like one big scam almost.
The Jewish circular economy, you know.
Yeah.
The billionaires, or the wealthy elite, the Jewish billionaires will – much of Jewish philanthropy, if you will, is devoted to promoting it and also to denigrating whites. Wonder if you go to like Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home, wonder why it's a hate whitey tour. It's because David Rubenstein, his philanthropy has done much to change the atmosphere of Monticello and many other monuments around the country. So they leverage their vast wealth that they've gained through several decades in America to promote this agenda. I think a lot of it has to do with after 2020 and the narrative of January 6, 2021. Is remember how they kind of spun it into a white supremacist, racist protest, and Joe Biden came out in 2021 claiming that the Biden administration, that white supremacists or white extremist domestic terrorists are the number one threat to the country, with zero evidence to that claim. The similar thing with the Jewish angle, where they're getting hypersensitive or this is overwrought rhetoric regarding the threat to them, the exaggerated threat to them, which is an old game with them, actually. It's an old strategy with them, is just a strategy there to, stifle any political opposition and to marginalize it, pathologize it, even criminalize it in many respects. Because, again, this goes back to definition. What is the definition of anti-Semitism? Based on what I read, it's criticism of Jewish organizations, criticism of how Jewish exercise power or their influence or particular Jewish groups. It's criticism of Israel, these things. And, you know, are these organizations, are these people, are these groups, just by virtue of them being Jewish, are they exempt from all criticism? You know, and that's basically the effect of the law. When you say it's the national strategy to combat anti-Semitism, really it's a national strategy to promote philo-Semitism and Jewish supremacy.
Right. And to delegitimize any open and honest discussion about Jewish power and influence in society. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is, you know, we have this coming directly from the federal government. And you talked about how the whole anti-Semitism and like the Holocaust museums and the promotion of this narrative and this, you know, frankly, totally fake historical narrative is like almost like one big scam. It's like one big racket that the organized Jewish community makes money off of and uses to advance their power and influence and to shut down any criticism of them. And, you know, it's like sort of like this circular racket. And I'm looking, I mean, I follow like the explicitly Jewish press pretty closely. And I mean, almost every single day there's like some article about how some Jewish billionaire is funding a new campaign. It's a social media campaign, maybe, or an educational program to educate the community about anti-Semitism. I mean, for example, Robert Kraft, the billionaire owner of the New England Patriots, mm-hmm. a Jewish guy, he launched a $25 million campaign earlier this year called "Stand Up to Jewish Hate," You might have seen it on Twitter or other social media platforms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people like
Tom. Is this Jewish hate or hatred of Jews?
Yeah, right. Stand Up to Jewish Hate is the name of the campaign. And this guy is putting, you know, he's sinking reportedly $25 million into this. And I mean, where is that money going? I mean, all I saw was basically a couple YouTube videos and, mm-hmm. you know, some celebrities get paid off to like promote it on Twitter and Instagram and things like that. So, I mean, this is obviously like a major concern for the organized Jewish community. And they've, using their influence and their extortion tactics, have turned it into a major issue for the United States federal government. And it has been for a very long time. You know, it's always a talking point with politicians. You know, we got to stand up to hate. We got to stand up to anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is rising. We see reports regularly from the ADL, for example, talking about how anti-Semitism is rising. That's another thing. I mean, you could follow any of these Jewish outlets, and literally every single day there's a report highlighting some study about how anti-Semitic attitudes are rising in the Netherlands or in Poland or in Russia or in Brazil or in whatever country. It's just incredible. But really, I think one of the key developments and what sort of sparked this conversation to develop this strategy in the Biden White House, I think a lot of it goes back to Kanye West's comments. In the late fall of 2022 and leading into December. Now, of course, it seems like he's largely backtracked and sort of, you know, downplayed a lot of those comments that he made. But he did say a lot of very powerful things. He basically described how Hollywood and you know, professional athletes and other, you know, professional entertainers are handled by Jews. By Jewish agents and in his case, he had a Jewish personal trainer, I think, who was also involved in some other scandals and had a very, very shady background. And you know, he basically was exposing a lot of things and how not only this concept of like a Jewish handler controlling celebrities and pro athletes also applied to politics. And I remember specifically an interview where he talked about how Barack Obama was handled by Rahm Emanuel, for example. And then, you know, President Trump was handled for pretty much his entire administration by his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. And there are many, many other examples of this throughout, you know, the history of American politics. And we see the Biden cabinet, for example. And I mean, it's just one Jew after another. I mean, I don't even know if there is any Gentiles in his administration, frankly, at least any white Christian males. I mean, Biden claims to be a Catholic, but he doesn't seem too Catholic to me. So I think Kanye West's comments really did shake things up in a big time way. And again, like I mentioned, he seems to have sort of backtracked on it. And who knows what was going on with that. That whole situation was very, very bizarre. I thought it was a very positive development that we had such a high profile figure actually talking about these things. Maybe not in the most intelligent way, but he certainly was talking about it in a very frank way, in a very unique and one of a kind way, in a way that only Kanye West could talk about these issues, I think. So I think that was an interesting development, and it really shook up the establishment. I mean, especially his comments on Alex Jones's show, where he was basically openly praising Hitler and disputing the official narrative of the Holocaust. I mean, it, you know, and again, he did that in a very bizarre way with that like bag over his head, and it was just a really weird situation. But nevertheless, I think it really did scare a lot of people in the establishment. It certainly startled the organized Jewish community. And that, coupled with like this whole Elon Musk takeover of Twitter, I think scared these people in a big time way. Although Elon Musk has proven to be basically a shill for the establishment. I mean, this guy is certainly no free speech absolutist, as many have claimed. I mean, at one point, my Twitter account was I've been like basically I don't know all the details. I don't even try to look into it and figure out what's going on. But I know for sure I've been shadow banned on Twitter for a very long time. In fact, for the longest time, you couldn't even post a link to my website because it would be immediately spammed as like a malicious website or a website trying to steal your information or whatever. But I do know that when this was happening with Kanye West, I was putting out tweets that were getting all of a sudden 20,000 views and likes and retweets and all this. And I've never had that sort of engagement on Twitter. So it was almost, I almost look back and it almost seems like it was like an experiment that they were doing. Like Kanye West is saying these things, we're going to loosen up Twitter, see what the reaction is. And people were going on Twitter and going nuts and saying, yeah, look, Kanye's right. Even a lot of people in you know, not sort of like the quote unquote white nationalist anti-Semitic movement or whatever, were noticing these things and saying, look, he's making a lot of good points. So I think that that did play a key role in that. And I don't know if you agree, if you have a response or anything, but I think that that was a key development in formulating this national strategy.
Yeah, the if you have a platform or you have a situation where people are free to express themselves, inevitably it's going to be quote anti-Semitic, because you're going to have a fair amount of criticism of Jews. And so their definition of anti-Semitism is any criticism. They can't even cope with any positive acknowledgement of their power, because it exposes or reveals too much to too many people, and it creates too many, difficult questions for them.
Well, and they often say that even making truthful statements about the role that Jews played, for example, in normalizing homosexuality and, and other things, you know, mass immigration and all these other things, it plays into quote unquote tropes about Jews.
Well, the American Jewish Committee just last month had a lady produce a video. This is by the American Jewish Committee, so it's not an inconsequential Jewish organization, where she's bragging about the role the Jews have played in promoting homosexuality, gay rights, same-sex marriage. She even highlights Harvey Milk, who was a sexual predator, yet the Navy named a ship after him.
I saw that video on Twitter, yeah.
She's admitting their role in all these destructive, disruptive things. She said under tikkun olam, they have the right to reform, repair the world as they see it. Basically, it's a license for them to disrupt and screw up your culture. And then you have to say, you have to say thank you. But again, you're an anti-Semite. If you quote that video, you'll be called an anti-Semite, because if they're going to take credit for these things and assume that they're positive elements, but if you take a more skeptical view of these things and indeed see them as negative developments, like degeneracy, destruction of marriage, crime, and these things, the dissolution of the heritage of America, and you see all the immigration, if you take a critical view of all these things, then you're guilty of engaging in collective guilt and anti-Semitism. But claim collective credit for these things, if you see them as a positive, you have to accept that if those people who see those as negative are going to apply collective guilt for it, you know. And so that's just logical. But the thing is, their game is, you know, when you control public discourse through the imposition of guilt via the Holocaust narrative and anti-Semitism, then you're in a position to do that. Their control of the narrative is based on that fear of Christian or ethnic white Americans of being accused of being anti-Semitic, because it has teeth, because that accusation hurts because of the control of the media and the institutional power they can bring to bear to people who speak up. And good example, you know, even billionaires aren't exempt from this, because much of that wealth is based on paper, which Jews, through their control of finance, are able to take away if you misbehave. And Kanye West was a great example of that.
Right. Yeah, his net worth was, I think it was like over $2 billion, and it went down to like, you know, he's basically a millionaire overnight.
Yeah, but yeah.
I mean, go from a billionaire to a millionaire overnight. That's a lot of power and influence. Mm-hmm. And you know, I can only I the video that you mentioned from the it was the American Jewish Congress, a lady from the American Jewish Congress.
The committee, I think.
Okay, yeah, I did see that, and I thought it was just incredible. And I mean, this is one example where this is a very social media friendly way of, you know, sort of Jews bragging about this stuff. But I mean, again, you read the Jewish press, you read organizations like the Jewish Daily Forward or the Jewish Telegraph Agency or Haaretz, and Jews will openly write and admit these things and brag about it and boast about it.
Yeah, Neil Gabler.
And there's many examples. Yeah.
Neil Gabler wrote Empire of Their Own about Hollywood. Hollywood, how it created the American identity. Now, again, if you look at what's happened, what's transpired in America, American culture for the past 60, 75, 80 years, and you may not be, you know, you may not like it. And if the Jews are behind it, then they have to take responsibility for it. And this control of, now, if you say that Hollywood is controlled by Jews, you're anti-Semite, but then they write a book and they brag about their control.
Yeah.
You know, there's Joel Stein's famous piece about that, about, you know, Jews control Hollywood, they should maintain control of Hollywood. It's a good thing. I think Dershowitz said a similar thing about Jewish power, how it's, of course, it's disproportionate and it needs to stay disproportionate. So if that's true, then, you know, for those with power, there must be accountability for it. They want a situation where there's no accountability for it. Idea of effectively making anti-Semitism sort of illegal, sort of something that one suffers, ostracism for and ruin if one is accused of such a thing, you create a system of de facto imposed philo-Semitism. And really, there should be a White House conference on philo-Semitism. You know,
absolutely.
Investigating that and the control that they – because it does – I mean, these are real problems because you do have – if you look at something like the State Department, all the higher positions are controlled by Jews. Well, that's an important position because these Jews are also primarily loyal to Israel. At least there's a good suspicion that they are, but the policies that they follow. The war in the Ukraine is primarily a Jewish thing. Jews started that war by provoking Russia, by undermining normal diplomatic approaches to these things, by prodding Russia, by pushing for the expansion of NATO, Victoria Nuland, Anthony Blinken, even our own attorney general, who has no role in Ukraine, bothered to fly to Ukraine and talk about convening a war crimes tribunal against Russia should they lose the war. Well, in order to impose a Nuremberg 2.0 on Russia, you have to defeat them totally, like they did Germany. That ain't going to happen. So what's he doing? But he claims his mandate for flying over to Ukraine is the fact that he's Jewish and that his parents survived the Holocaust. See, this is the problem. Their Jewish identity trumps everything, which is why they can't be trusted in high governmental positions or cultural positions, because that's identity is primary, and they talk about it. And that raises a whole lot of questions, because we live in a liberal society which says, well, no, what matters is you're a U.S. citizen, your devotion to the American creed, which is free speech, the Bill of Rights, these things, and it doesn't matter what race you are, as long as you just you embrace the propositions that define America. Well, if you look at the greater Jewish organizations like the ADL, the American Jewish Committee, Organized Jewish Community, and the influence the ADL, the influence that it imposes or on the government, they are adamantly opposed to free speech. They call it hate speech. Now,
yep.
With America, all America is, for better or for worse, what it is. I'm a little ambivalent about America, the idea, because liberalism simply is a false promise, and no one follows the Constitution. So no one really believes in these things, in these ideas. They break them all the time. But nevertheless, what defines America is something like free speech. That's what America is. If you don't have that, you don't have America. And that's what they're trying to do. And to the extent that you come out against free speech, whether it's combating hate speech or anti-Semitism, you are against free speech and you are un-American. And that's how these organizations should be investigated. There should be un-American activities investigation, a committee on this, and these groups are conspiring against the U.S. Constitution, against my rights and your rights and everyone's rights as U.S. citizens, and they should be treated as enemies of the state and enemies of the American people, because they've come out foursquare against it. They are against America. They're against everything that she supposedly stands for, and they are conspiring to destroy what remains of it. And this announcement by the White House is open declaration of war on free speech on America. Because what they define as anti-Semitism is going online, organizing, trying to raise funds, take part in public debate. All the activity they're going against, what they're calling violence, is simply free speech.
Yeah, well said. I couldn't agree with you more. And the most insidious aspect of all this is that they masquerade this campaign as some righteous, benevolent, endeavor to combat hate and this sort of thing.
Yeah, it's always hate.
You know, they're the good guys and we're the bad guys for noticing these sorts of things.
Hate is what they disagree with.
Right.
You know, here's a good example is sort of the intersectionality of this. And this is where you know, basically where if you – and I try to tell people that is even moderate people. So you don't know, but you're an anti-Semite based on the terms that the White House laid out in this action plan. Here's a good example I'll quote from it. Today, the Biden-Harris administration is releasing the first ever U.S. national strategy to counter anti-Semitism. This strategy includes over 100 new actions the administration will take to raise awareness of anti-Semitism and its threat to American democracy, protect Jewish communities, reverse normalization of anti-Semitism, and build cross-community solidarity. While anti-Semitic incidents are most directly and intensely affect the Jewish community, anti-Semitism threatens all of us. Anti-Semitic conspiracy theories fuel other forms of hatred, discrimination, and bias, including discrimination against other religious minorities, racism, sexism, anti-LGBTQI+ hate. Can you imagine typing that? Anti-Semitism seeks to divide Americans from one another, erodes trust in government and non-government institutions, undermines our democracy. So basically, based on this sort of intersectional approach to anti-Semitism, if you're opposed to grooming children in schools for drag queen story hour or corporations promoting sexual degeneracy and perversion like Target or Bud Light, or if you're guilty of anti-Semitism because it's all related.
You know? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well said. I mean, yeah, it's pretty incredible, and it's not even that hard to see through this anymore. It's like so obvious. And I mean, even just reading, like I have it's a 60-page document. And also what's interesting, and maybe we can talk about this, is on page 4, there's a legal disclaimer that basically says that this strategy is not law-abiding. It doesn't, you know, change any existing laws. It's basically just guidance. So it's almost like another PR stunt, just like we saw with COVID. None of the COVID, quote-unquote, regulations and mandates, none of that was lawful. It was all basically guidance that you were expected to follow. And I view this as more or less the same thing. You know, they're just expecting everybody to go along with this and get in line and implement all these policy changes. And, you know, they describe it as a whole of government approach and how the entire federal government is going to change and implement these policy recommendations. Not only the federal government. I mean, they're talking about literally going out to, like, rural museums in the middle of the country and, you know, creating like an anti-Semitism awareness campaign like in the museum. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. But one thing I wanted to bring up, and this is clear, right? You know, Joe Biden has been talking about this from the moment he announced his campaign for president in 2020.
This very program does the very thing that's supposedly combating. This is going to create more, quote, anti-Semitism.
Which ADL would use to
raise more funds. See how it's like it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Now, what do you mean by that? Just the fact that it's so like blatant and brazen in your face, like, look,
yes,
we
people
Jews,
are
going to
talk like our conversation right now. They'll follow social media and what people are saying, and the ADL report this as an increase in anti-Semitism, a reaction to what they're doing.
An increase in noticing. I mean, really, that's all anti-Semitism is just noticing. Obvious facts and the reality in front of us and just the role that these people play, which is really no secret. If you are objective and really want to figure out what is going on and who is making these decisions and, you know, formulating U.S. foreign policy and domestic policy and economic policy, banking policy. I mean, just look at who's in charge, and it's not hard to put two and two together if you're objective, if you can think for yourself and think critically. But one thing I wanted to bring up, and I was sort of mentioning this, Biden, I mean, from the moment Biden announced his 2020 campaign, he was talking about Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. And you see in the very introduction of this national strategy, quote, 6 years ago, neo-Nazis marched from the shadows through Charlottesville, Virginia, chanting, Jews will not replace us. With torches in hand, they spewed the same anti-Semitic bile and hate that we heard across Europe in the 1930s. This is like literally exactly the way he announced his campaign. Mm-hmm. And he talks about what happened in Charlottesville drove me to run for president. The very soul of our nation was hanging in the balance, and it still is today. I mean, it's just incredible how they continue to bring up this one event, which shows you the power of like real life activism and just, you know, getting out there, not being afraid. And I mean, Charlotte, we could talk about Charlottesville. I didn't even really want to talk about Charlottesville, but, you know, the problems with it and some of the things that happened. But overall, I mean, I think the event itself was a totally, I mean, obviously it was a totally legally sanctioned. Yeah.
The Hefty Report exposed the collusion of the governor and the city of Charlottesville in intentionally creating a conflict there.
Absolutely, which is very typical in all of these, you know, with any conservative, even with any Republican, even mainstream Republican events are now being like shut down and described as terrorists. This
is the power of narrative also versus like reality. You spin a narrative of an event. You can take certain, you know, facts of an event and an occurrence, and you can spin the narrative around those facts. Like a good example, was there a riot at Charlottesville? Well, yes, there was. Then you can spin a narrative. It was a neo-Nazi riot because there are some people who might have identified as so-called neo-Nazis or, you know, dissident right, which then you can call a Nazi or whatever, National Socialist. There wasn't anybody from the German National Socialist Workers Party because it doesn't exist anymore.
No. You know? And I don't even think you could find a single person to identify as a neo-Nazi that was even in attendance that day.
Unless they were a Fed.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, with the FBI. Now, again, this is the power of narrative. So you have a situation where in August 2017, there was a permitted protest. I think it was over the taking down of several Confederate statues. And this was, I guess, nominally at least the pretext for the day's events. People were coming all around the speakers. Unite the Right rally, I think they call it.
Yes, absolutely.
Unite the Right. And so they had the permit. And listen, if you live in America, a so-called liberal society, get the permit, let the people come and give their speech, say their piece and go home. No. Antifa was brought in. Okay. And we all know the story of Antifa. It's a Jewish organization and it works, not basically a step or two removed away from the FBI and also other intelligence, law enforcement agencies.
The Department of Homeland Security is literally funding organizations and universities that actively employ Antifa members.
We saw
that recently
with that grant, that guy Lodenthal, I think in Ohio or something. And they talk about openly doing illegal things. So basically, there was a stand down in Charlottesville by the police, and this was again exposed by the Hefty Report and the local government there, because it's a carpetbagger government in Charlottesville. Basically, it's I think the mayor of Charlottesville at the time was a Jew from New York. Okay, so they really have very little affinity to the surrounding people who live there. It's a college town, like most college towns. There's a bunch of shit liberals, libs, you know. And they so basically the police let this riot begin because they didn't allow the people with the permit who were speaking a way to leave it without bringing the conflict with Antifa, who are there illegally. So there was a riot. There was some conflict. Okay, and so then spun this narrative of, you know, I think that the people with the tiki torches were the night before or something, whatever.
Right. Yep, that was the night before.
I guess tiki torches are illegal now. They're trying to prosecute people for carrying tiki torches now. Put them in jail.
What do they call it? Ethnic intimidation or some nonsense? Yes. I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's the same as burning crosses in someone's yard or something. But so that's the narrative. A good example. You have another narrative. January 6th, right? You have to call it insurrection. If you're an FBI agent, if you don't call it insurrection, you lose your security clearance. And so the media, insurrection, although it wasn't anything close to insurrection, but nevertheless, that narrative has been spun and now it's become a matter of law because of the prosecutions by the U.S. attorney, Matthew Graves, for the Biden administration and the going after the January 6th protesters, calling it an insurrection, even though there's no evidence of insurrection. But nevertheless, you've had these convictions. I think it was the Proud Boys. You have the the Oath Keepers being convicted on no evidence at all, just on a narrative. Talk about a narrative of the Holocaust. That's a narrative, which if you scrutinize it, there's very little evidence for the ever-shifting narratives that comprise the Holocaust. But this is the power of narratives, because once you have that narrative, then you can pretty much kind of create reality around it. Spin reality. That's what Joe Biden did with that. You know, he didn't say that people should come out, should have a right to give a speech. That's when they got a permit for it. And the police should have prevented the riot. No, he just used it to grandstand for his campaign and create a narrative that somehow there was this brewing threat of right-wing violent extremism in the country. And that carried over to January 6th. No basis or whatsoever.
No. In fact, I mean, we talked about gaslighting at one point in a podcast we did. It's almost like the exact opposite of reality. I mean, these guys that were involved in the Unite the Right rally showed up. Again, totally, perfectly, legally sanctioned event, openly attempting to coordinate and work with local law enforcement. And yet they were sabotaged, and Antifa was allowed, basically, to more or less attack these people. And yeah. if you defended yourself, you were being, you know, now, you know, you were likely prosecuted or faced some very serious legal and social repercussions. I mean, it's just a total outrage. And we saw the same thing with January 6th. And many other events.
George Floyd riots, summer of 2020. Yeah.
Yeah, it's gaslighting, it's narrative control, exactly. Well, so getting back to this national strategy, you had sort of – I don't know, were you reading directly from the actual document? Yeah. So one thing that stood out to me is how they talk about they're one of their main points is that quote-unquote anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and the rising tide of anti-Semitism fuels racial and ethnic and religious hatred against other groups as well. And they mention Black, Brown Americans, Asian Americans, Native Hawaiians, Pacific Islanders, LGBTQI plus Muslims, women and girls. But what about white people? I mean, white people are like literally totally left out of this entire conversation. This entire thing is just one big anti-white grift to prevent white people from recognizing that Jews are organizing openly and coordinating directly with the federal government to prevent any sort of discussion of their activities, to prevent any sort of rise in racial consciousness. I mean, this is exactly what this is all about.
Mm-hmm. Because they're still the majority. And if there's any, if there is some sort of ethnogenesis where the white people develop some sort of, you know, cohesive identity, politically be very, you know, difficult for them to continue on with this enterprise. So they need to keep whites atomized, weak, feeling guilty. Any assertion of identity or interest is considered, again, white supremacy. Yeah.
And yet you can positively identify as Black or Brown or Mexican or gay or whatever, or Jewish. And you know, that's normal, that's healthy, that's natural. Yet if you positively identify as white or even as Christian these days, it's like, you know, you're some racist supremacist. And this has been the case for a very, very long time. Have you ever seen that Wikipedia like meme where it's like white pride, racist, evil, supremacist, Black pride? You know, it's a healthy expression of Black identity. And, you know, it goes like that for pretty much all these other minority groups.
I mean, in the 70s, you had the white power movement. And, of course, that was – I remember you could see his buttons. My brother had a button as a joke, I remember, you know, as an oddity, white power. And he kept it in his drawer. I thought it was interesting. But you really think about it is, what's the opposite of white power? White weakness?
Right, exactly.
You know,
I mean,
who wants to have no power? I mean, it's like kind of like you want some power. Now, here with America, of course, what it was for the longest, and this goes to speak about white supremacy, is that the default of America was, you know, ethnic white European Americans. And so that was the system. And so minorities on the periphery were invited in and gradually given more, you know, allowed to be given more rights and privileges and immunities, and these things, and bring into the mainstream of American life. And the understanding of most white Americans at the time would be that these people would become middle class and culturally behave like whites. That was the presumption. Something that's entirely different now. Now that presumption is considered white supremacy. You see that like in the African American Museum in Washington, D.C., where attributes of whiteness was like punctuality, politeness, exactitude, these sort of things. These are the things.
Speaking properly, like using correct grammar. Yeah. Knowing how to read and write.
Yeah. These are the things that make a modern society possible and functional. If you don't do those things, the society deteriorates. And you have something like you have like in South Africa or Jackson, Mississippi or Baltimore, Maryland or Detroit or, you know, Chicago. In a way, I can see what they're saying is there was a writer, Zora Neale Hurston. I think she wrote The Color Purple. She was a literate, a black lady in the early 20th century. And she had a quote. She said something to the effect that slavery was the price I paid for civilization. Meaning her introduction into the West ultimately was through slavery. And her ancestors were brought to this country as slaves, but they also brought them into the Western world, and it afforded them a great opportunity that they wouldn't have had in Africa. And so, to the extent that she was literate and civilized, she acknowledged this was a byproduct of slavery. It wasn't a justification for it, simply an acknowledgement of reality. And this is sort of the irony that they're confronted with is that particularly black Americans who enjoy a much higher standard of living than their African counterparts or their cousins back home is they have relatively prospered and done very well in America because of what America is. But they have to acknowledge the fact that this was largely a product of slavery. Now, you can just look at history and go, oh, one of the ironies of history, and this, you know, that's interesting, and move on. But no, it becomes the basis for like demands for reparations, excuses for their own failure, their inability to compete or cope, and with other ethnic groups that have subsequently emigrated to the country, like Asians, right, like Southeast Asians, that do very well, and becomes a source of great resentment and a justification for endless claims.
That's interesting because, you know what, her observation is more or less basically what Adolf Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf. And I had never encountered this idea until I read that book. And it was so eye-opening because I had never even heard it expressed that way. That, look, the concept of civilization, all of the advancements in technology and architecture, culture, painting, or, artistic expression, all these things – really come from the mind of in the version that I have, it's the Aryan man. I mean, you could probably interpret that any number of different ways, but basically white Western Christian civilization.
Yeah, the Occident.
And that I had never even considered that. I'd never heard anybody express it that way. And to me, that's not even like a supremacist thing to say. It's just a recognition of reality that apparently this black woman even recognized as well, which I was unaware of. But I mean, really, that's something that's a factual observation that is probably one of the most hidden secrets in the entire world at this point. Mm-hmm. It remains to be true. I mean, now of course that's not to denigrate or to delegitimize accomplishments of other races. It's just the fact that generally speaking, the advancement of technology and all these other things are largely the result of white people. And I think that that's an important thing that should be recognized and understood, and I think it would eliminate a lot of the hostility that we see amongst and I mean really this hostility amongst races is really stirred up by the Jewish media.
Oh, definitely, because one thing is mass immigration, is a Jewish operation, and also the fact that you would have immigration in the United States that was primarily non-European, third world, black or brown, if you will, is done intentionally. And that was the idea behind the 1965, Hart-Celler Act, which was a culmination of 40 years of Jewish agitation to change the country's immigration laws. For 40 years, the country pretty much had stopped immigration and did well. And nevertheless, we're told, and this is, again, this is a function of Jewish control of media, whether it's the print and electronic, the idea that America is a nation of immigrants, that itself is Jewish propaganda. That's like diversity is a strength is Jewish propaganda. These are all slogans that are created by the American, I think it was Ben Ibrith and also the ADL with diversity is our strength. But the idea that, again, didn't matter the ethnic makeup of the country. The demographics don't matter, but nevertheless, they worked to change the demographics. So that they're it's also done with the sort of the racial narrative coming out of the civil rights movement was, the oppression of blacks and the guilt of whites, as if it was just that simple. And so that's the narrative that was spun. And so Civil Rights Act and these things was an admission of guilt by white Americans. And they were judged guilty at the bar of history. That's what Christopher Caldwell writes about in this book, a very good book, Age of Entitlement. And he's a mainstream conservative guy. He's like a mainstream Heritage Foundation conservative. And he wrote one of the most revolutionary critiques of civil rights, meaning that you're not going to get rid of this until you repeal civil rights, because you have to get rid of that regime, because that regime is being used to destroy the country.
Yeah, well, and it's almost like a cope for the reality of what I just basically what Hitler outlined in the book and what the black author that you mentioned recognized. Mm. It's just a cope for the reality that, look, this is the way the world works.
The differences of culture.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like just the reality of the way the world is.
Well, they say they like diversity.
Right, so, but they actively destroy it to where, yes. I mean, geez, you can't go anywhere. You can't go to any major city or even minor city in America without, try to go into a Walmart of any city anywhere in the country, and you will see people from
a dabble
from South America. You'll see people from Asia. You'll see people from the Middle East. It's like, what the hell? What are they all doing here? Like, don't they have their own countries? I mean, it's just totally crazy and out of control at this point.
Well, they've intentionally created a multiracial democracy, at the same time denying whites the agency to identify as a group.
And all, you see all in the name of fighting anti-Semitism as this national strategy basically outlines.
Yes. Yeah. The Tucker Carlson, I think it was the interview he did with Adam Carolla, where he said, he predicted all this agitation is going to produce white consciousness, and there'll be a white leader. And when that happens, I'm going to say, you don't speak for me. I'm an individual. F you, man.
Right? I was going to say, I think he even used some stronger language than that.
Yeah, F you, man. You don't know me. As if, well, I don't know. You join a labor union doesn't mean you're collectively organized. Doesn't mean you deny that you're an individual. It's collective effort. It's like if you're an army, the group that forms an army is going to conquer the group of individuals whose two individuals can form an army. So it's just organizing, understanding how political power is organized and used, where under conservative or libertarian ideas, that's all considered evil, because after all, we have the Constitution and the government's neutral, so you don't need to do that, because you can just make the best argument, win an election. See, it's just that simple, John. But Adam Carolla said something in an interview. He goes, oh yeah, white people have the privilege of not having to belong to a group.
Yeah, exactly.
How does that work in a multiracial democracy, though?
Exactly. Well, that's what I mean, and that's the main takeaway, is that this whole system is designed, but frankly, by the organized Jewish community to delegitimize any form of, white racial identity, and encouraging it in other groups, which, I mean, go back and look at the history of the NAACP, for example, mm-hmm. which was probably one of the first, more mainstream, powerful, organized black organizations. And who was involved in that?
Yeah, the Spingarn brothers are Jewish. And it was also done to destroy the sort of the black nationalist movement.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Any form of positive, healthy racial nationalism is, totally anathema to these people. And speaking of, just to prove my point about how this whole, the whole point of combating anti-Semitism is to prop up this multiracial empire where Jews rule over all of us. and we're all just basically slaves. This is a direct quote from this paper. Protecting the Jewish community from anti-Semitism is essential to our broader fight against all forms of hate, bigotry, and bias, and to our broader vision of a thriving, inclusive, and diverse democracy.
Yes.
And I mean, I think that basically kind of like sums up. Now, of course, white people, there's no room for white people in this, of course. As we mentioned, I mean, they don't even mention white Americans at all throughout this entire paper. I don't think. I haven't read the entire thing. I would be shocked if that were the case. Aside from saying like white supremacy is like the greatest threat to the country, which they you know, say numerous times throughout this, and that's a talking point of the Biden administration.
In order to defend our democracy or their democracy, they have to engage in all types. They have to engage in like intelligence coups against the sitting president, right? You saw that with the Durham report.
The Durham report, and of course, there's no recommendations for prosecuting anybody and holding them accountable for these straight up just outrageous crimes.
Yeah, crimes against the state. These are treasonous acts. Yeah, and they were conspiring against the sitting. Not only did they try to interfere in an election, they did interfere in an election in 2016. You had the Hillary Clinton campaign commission a false intelligence report from a foreigner, from a Russian, and it was on a Russian and a Brit and a Brit. And then it was fed to the FBI, which they used to get a false warrant to spy on the Trump campaign. And that's out there. Everyone knows it. And this involved Obama, Hillary Clinton, I think at the time, wasn't she the Secretary of State? And then that doesn't work. He wins. And this is an endorsement of Trump. And then they – again, the whole thing with the whole Russian collusion thing is a product of false intelligence. False Pfizer
fake. It's like one fake manufactured – politically motivated narrative after the other. Facts be damned. Facts do not matter to these people.
And then this whole thing comes up with Hunter Biden laptop, which isn't just dick pics and him doing drugs with prostitutes. It's exposure of the Biden crime family, which is, you know, this is influence peddling racket, you know, and the fact that, you know, at the very least, the president, not, you know, he can be compromised with all this stuff. That's another factor here. But this with this laptop, which is genuine, the FBI knew it was genuine. Everyone knew it was genuine. It's covered up. The collusion left the FBI with big tech and social media to suppress the story, the New York Post story. And then you have that false letter that's signed. That was commissioned by the now attorney, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, with an assistant director of the CIA to sign that.
Now, real quick, Anthony Blinken, he's Jewish too, right?
Or does that matter, John?
It's like it's unbelievable. I mean, it's like,
yes,
it is literally. I know. Well, I just say that just because
but again,
it has to be pointed out. Yeah,
it's not supposed to. Based on the myth of America, it's not supposed to matter.
It's not supposed to matter. Well, that is the myth of America. Exactly.
It's the fact that obviously Jews are an exception. They're a different group of a group that dwell among their own. The fact that the White House, no other group can convene at the White House and have the White House endorse a national strategy to pursue their interests openly.
No. Not at this level. Not at this level.
No.
I mean, they may play lip service to other groups, but the LGBT, and they'll fly the flag and that sort of thing. But no, not at this level. And who knows? I'm curious to know how much money went into this, because there was literally – I think the report even says there was over a – was it 1,000 – let me see if I can find it really quick. I think it was 1,000 groups. Yeah, no. Sorry. 1,000 Jewish community stakeholders, faith and civil rights leaders, state and local officials, and more were involved in this whole effort in coming up with this national strategy. How much money went into this? How much money did Douglas Emhoff make doing this? Was he paid extra to do this? What about these other groups? I mean, who knows? Who wrote this report? How much were they paid? They probably spent millions of dollars on this.
Who voted for Doug Emhoff?
Right. Who voted for Kamala Harris? Nobody in the Democratic primary even.
Well, we live in a fortified democracy, see, with mail-in ballots and media censorship. That's normalized, like with Facebook. This is all done. Time Magazine, the Molly Ball.
Fortified.
They bragged about
yep.
You know, fortifying the election, securing the election. as if it's someone owns it or something, as if the outcome they had to guarantee in these things, you know. And so, again, it's
a fortified Jewish democracy, basically run by the ADL at this point. I mean, that's the sort of society we're operating in. I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off.
Private intelligence criminal operation. It was the same the SPLC, and that's been proven in court. You know, where they engaged in all types of illegal spying in California, and that was exposed, and engaging false information, and then they feed it to intelligence to the FBI, but the ADL compromised the FBI longer ago. That was through Louis Rosenstiel and Lamar Lansky, where they had the goods on Herbert Hoover.
That's the thing. Like this whole history of FBI corruption and basically being a private intelligence and like dirty tricks organization for the organized Jewish community. This goes back a long time. I mean, decades at this point.
It's gotten worse lately because there was a time the FBI put up airs of professionalism, and it was always full of careers. But the men who staffed it were sort of these normal, often Catholics. Catholics swarmed to the FBI, and they were family men, and had, you know, so it was obviously the culture was more conservative back then, and so the FBI's, you know, dirty tricks often targeted what we called the left back then, you know, like the murder of Freddie Hampton and COINTELPRO, and often the people that exposed this stuff were often leftists in the 60s and 70s with their journalism. But now it's shifted to the left, and now they love the FBI. They love the CIA. They, you know, you have people like on MSNBC quoting CIA, you know, intelligence studies. This is just something that can be trusted. John Brennan's on the, you know, MSNBC. He's like, wait a second, I thought you all used to criticize this stuff.
Remember during the Bush administration, I mean, these people hated the FBI. They hated the CIA. They were all these evil. And of course, many of them were actually white back then, although there were plenty of Jews involved as well. But it's a much different, you know, much different scenario.
Well,
now.
That's something here. You know, so now the FBI hires a bunch of, you know, crazy lesbians, you know, women in pantsuits, as it's referred to. And you saw that the Mark Hauck trial in Pennsylvania, the pro-lifer who Merrick Garland tried to prosecute for trying to fend off a crazy Jew attacking his son in front of an abortion clinic. He's a pro-life activist who says rosaries in front of abortion clinics and tries to persuade women not to kill their unborn babies. He was attacked by this crazy Jewish fellow in Philadelphia. Even the local prosecutor, Krasner, didn't prosecute the case. And the guy tried to bring us the crazy Jew tried to bring a civil case, which he didn't show up for, so he defaulted and the case was dropped. But Merrick Garland decided to prosecute him, and sort of to terrorize pro-lifers. And they sent 20 armed federal agents early morning, dawn raid on his house. He's the father of seven kids. And of course, Josh Hawley had a hearing on Merrick Garland, oversight hearing, where he lambasted Merrick Garland for doing this. And he asked Merrick Garland, what do you have against these people? And there's a picture of the Hauck family at church, and you know, the girls are all in dresses and the boys are all in suits and they're all happy, and he's got a pretty wife. And what do you have against these people? Well, that's what he has against these people. If you read the authoritarian personality, Jews hate people like that.
Yep. Normal, you know, normal heterosexual Christian families. Yeah, exactly.
And you can't, if you look at how Merrick Garland has executed his powers at the Justice Department, his Jewish identity is key to that. I'm sorry. He's not a liberal.
Well, exactly. You know. And
his,
I mean, even
didn't prevent him from covering up like the Oklahoma City bombing back in 95 when he covered up John Doe number 2. You know, it's not a liberal. You know, the ADL is not liberal.
No. Well, I mean, Merrick Garland's Jewish identity is on like full display. If for anybody that's paying attention anyways, that knows the facts and virtually everything he does. Now, you had mentioned, you know, him appointing a quote unquote like special investigator to prosecute war crimes against Russia. Guess who he appointed? The quote unquote best known Nazi hunter, Eli Rosenbaum.
Is he still employed?
Eli Rosenbaum is apparently still employed by the Department of Justice.
Let me ask you, can you go after like the sons and daughters of Nazis, same way that like Holocaust, I'm a son and daughter of a Holocaust survivor. Can you also prosecute the sons and daughters of Nazis?
If they say the wrong thing or like say something good about their relative, yeah, you probably could.
So, what are these Nazi hunters doing? I mean, I'm looking at the calendar, and wait a second, you know, that's any active Nazi would be well into his 90s.
It's like 75 years after the fact, and they're still going after these people. It is just outrageous.
Yeah.
There's, you know what, there's one last paragraph I want to read from this paper, and it kind of just demonstrates, further demonstrates the basic point that the whole idea to counter anti-Semitism is basically to prevent, again, any sort of criticism or noticing of what the Jews are up to, any sort of public discussion of it, any sort of quote-unquote mainstreaming of discussing what the Jews are up to and noticing what they're doing and how much power and influence they really have, coupled with maintaining this multiracial Jewish-run empire where white people are basically at the bottom of the totem pole and all these other minorities are elevated to a certain extent but still Jews maintain the supremacy at the top. It says here, and this is on page 6, and there's some interesting bits that I'd like to kind of pick apart here with you. It says here, while anti-Semitism most directly and intensely affects the American Jewish community, anti-Semitism also threatens the democracy, values, safety, and rights of all Americans, except for white people, of course. The hatred of Jews shares much in common with other forms of hate, such as racism, Islamophobia, homophobia, transphobia, and misogyny. It also has unique characteristics that require tailored responses and can manifest distinctively. While many American Jews identify as a vulnerable minority group, especially as anti-Semitism surges, Jews tend to be assailed for having too much privilege or too much power. This is a persistent feature of anti-Semitism. It rests on a conspiracy theory. So, Tim, it's just a conspiracy theory, right, that Jews basically control the Biden administration and that Jews control Hollywood and that Jews like Joel Stein, for example, would write a column in the Los Angeles Times that we mentioned previously in this podcast where he said that as a proud Jew, I want America to know about our accomplishment. Yes, we control Hollywood. I don't care if Americans think we're running the news media, Hollywood, Wall Street, or the government. I just care that we get to keep running them.
Mm-hmm.
So you notice these things and you are a conspiracy theorist. Any form of anti-Semitism or noticing what Jews are up to is itself a conspiracy theory. I mean, again, it's like gaslighting on an extreme level, total psychological manipulation, and these people are experts at it.
Well, again, I'm not going to call out – well, I will just for the sake of the conversation. But obviously the double standard hypocrisy and what you read is Jewish privilege and Jewish power – a disproportionate power in these things, that shouldn't be a basis for criticism, even though they're overrepresented among the wealthy, among the elite, among those who control the media and banking and politics and finance, the Biden administration. That overrepresentation is not an evidence of privilege or ethnic nepotism or networking. And criticism of that isn't – one would say criticism of that privilege would be an element of democracy. But to them, it's anti-Semitism, you see. However, if you cite something like black underrepresentation in things like medicine or the sciences or underrepresentation of women in the sciences, that itself is a prima facie case of the patriarchy of white male supremacy.
Of white supremacy, exactly.
White supremacy. And that can be criticized. Now, I'm not a believer in equality across the board. I think there are indeed genuine group differences that result in different outcomes. But nevertheless, I'm just by their own language. Why can't we if we were supposed to think that we live in an egalitarian society where everything is equal or there's equity, whatever that means, it has to be fair, you know, equally represented across all fields, then Jews are the most guilty because they're the most overrepresented in all the you know these elite fields, whether it be the finance or politics or entertainment and culture, and the fact that a group can enjoy so much disproportionate power is that's going to affect how the power is exercised, whether it's culture with movies and music or politics. Again, and the fact that the White House would be compelled, someone told, you know, ordered Joe Biden to do this is an indication of that of the Jewish power, which we're not apparently we're not able or not allowed to criticize.
I'd like to do a FOIA request for the text messages between Doug Emhoff and Jonathan Greenblatt, and we could probably really get to the bottom of this.
Yeah.
Could you imagine? Yeah. I mean, well, they're probably smarter than that, but, well, who knows? Maybe not. I mean, that would be an interesting thing to do.
Mm-hmm. And also,
I need to write that down. And
if you're having a national strategy on anti-Semitism, you might want to have other points of view.
Right, I mean, exactly,
cause
yeah.
Because there is an attitude among Jews that everything, whatever resentment they face or criticism they face, it's always something wrong with those who are criticizing them or who have resentment towards them. It's never anything they do. They never do anything wrong. They do everything right, according to the American Jewish Committee video that was published. We do what's right. So – but nevertheless, you have someone like Barbara Leonard Spector who openly admits that her job in Sweden was to destroy Sweden's ethnic basis of their ethno state, if you will. And also Jews throughout Europe, their job is to destroy the basis for the ethnic states of Europe. And this efforts by Jews, and she says this, by Jews throughout Europe, is going to create great resentment. And that's just something they're just going to have to live with. Well, she's admitting that what she's doing is going to create resentment. And that resentment is a product of what Jews are doing.
Right. Exactly. No, yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, the Jew, I mean, literally the Jews are like the original, we didn't do nothing, you know, like that whole meme that came up with like the whole Black Lives Matter thing, like this guy, oh, this black guy, he didn't do anything. They are the original, we didn't do nothing. Like nothing is ever our fault. None of this is rational. It's just irrational hate and just scapegoating and conspiracy theories about Jews because of your own faults or because of your own problems or whatever. It's just, you know, again,
and also the
psychological manipulation, gaslighting. Yeah.
Their success is solely a result of their higher intelligence, their hard work and their skill and their talent. I'm not saying that they're not intelligent, that many of them are not talented. Many of them are talented and all that. Although I think less so now, I think, their privilege has gotten the better of them now. They should be much more clever. I mean, Abe Foxman was much smarter than Jonathan Greenblatt.
Right. Yep.
ADL used to not be commonly identified as a liberal or because I think, broadly speaking, people have a very critical view of the ADL now, I think. Those in the know or moderately informed know that it's highly politicized. And But even that is, wait a second, but they're only 2% of the population. So even if there are, if they do possess, you know, on average higher IQs and these things, the super white majority, there's so many of them, would be, just by sheer numbers, would be represented greater, you know, in these elite institutions if they weren't discriminated against, which we now know, like the Ivy League now are openly discriminated against white Americans, you know, white males particularly. And if they get away,
they're even discriminating against Asians now, right? I mean, like
that's what the lawsuit's about. It's kind of funny, right? The lawsuit is, no one can ever openly advocate on behalf of white Americans. They always need a proxy, like Asians or something. You know, so right now Asians are being discriminated against. But again, I always find it interesting that, you know, Jews, they claim higher verbal IQs, but at the end of the day, they have to engage in censorship, dude, because they can't cope with the debates.
Well, they can't handle the truth. I mean,
no.
That's ultimately what this all boils down to, is they just cannot deal with anybody that's knowledgeable about this stuff, openly, you know, saying the things that we're saying, for example. I mean, that's very, very clear.
And inevitably, once they're in power, they become commissars. They turn universities into indoctrination centers, and they become political commissars to these universities. You know, so it's the chutzpah. They go too far. That's what, like – now we have to deal with commissars like Jonathan Greenblatt, who are ordering, you know, social media. They actually send agents into these outfits to make sure that speech is policed, content's policed.
I mean, they have like training programs for social media companies. Mm-hmm.
They train the FBI.
Yeah, well, right.
And law enforcement.
Yeah, and they're going to the Holocaust Museum and everything.
Yeah, if you're a cadet at Quantico, and before you get your badge, you have to take a tour of the Holocaust Museum and pay for it, from what I understand.
Oh, no.
It'll be a burst. So you have to get that – before you get that badge, you got to go on a tour of the Holocaust Museum.
Yeah.
How's that relevant to United States and law enforcement, I guess, you know, tolerance of these things. Yeah.
Well, you know what, actually, that there's two last topics I want to address before we wrap up here.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of gets to one of the main ones is, you know, we've talked about like narratives and narrative control. And I mean, like, I'm curious, like, to you, how central is the official World War II narrative to every other contemporary narrative we see today? I mean, to me, it's pretty clear. I mean, if you really dig into this, that the official World War II narrative and the Holocaust and the demonization of Hitler and the quote unquote Nazis and all this nonsense, this is really the linchpin of Jewish power. This is the basis for the national strategy to counter anti-Semitism. It's the basis for massive non-white immigration. It's the basis for multiculturalism and diversity and this just overall attack on white people and white nations. It's the basis for everything. It is basically the linchpin, the main narrative, which basically informs all the other narratives of politics and race and whatever else.
Well, yes, because if you deign to criticize Jewish power or any Jew, or any Jewish organization, they'll accuse you of being the second coming of Adolf Hitler.
Immediately. Yeah. I mean, like, yeah. Instantly. That's what it goes back to.
It's reductio ad Hitlerum, as they say. And that narrative is very important. If you follow the historiography of the Second World War, which most people don't, but you know, you're familiar how war was being treated in the aftermath of the war. The Holocaust factored very little in. In fact, that term wasn't even commonly used until the late 1970s. There was a CBS miniseries by that name, I think based on a book called The Holocaust. Before that, it was called The Shoah.
By the way, wasn't that the first time that like a naked human was introduced into like television or –
Yes, you had fleeting nudity, I think, in the CBS series. I remember watching as a kid, and of course,
weird how that works, right?
Yes, yeah. And then, yeah. Of course, then with Schindler's List in 2005, 2006, it was broadcast. I think it was 12, 13 years after it was in the theaters, 1993. ABC put it on uninterrupted, without commercials. It's so important, uninterrupted, 3-hour broadcast of Schindler's List, unedited, and of course, there's nudity. Not only is there just nudity with the showers, there's actually sex scenes in there.
It's almost like it's a big psyop or something.
Yeah, and at the time, I remember one of the funniest remarks I heard at the time was from Howard Stern, because he had his run-ins with the FCC with obscenity in his show, you know, the Shock Jock, and he was kind of flabbergasted with the ABC decided that. The issue was so important that the show should not be edited. So you have to have nudity because of the Holocaust. And he commented on his radio show with Robin Quivers. And he goes, yeah, you just want to show nudity on television, just kill a few Jews.
Jeez.
That's his comment.
He literally said that. I wasn't aware of that. Wow.
And I was like, oh, and it's kind of funny because if you think about it, that's actually – I don't know if he understood the significance of what he was saying. It was very true because the Hollywood production code in the 1960s was shattered with a Holocaust film. It was called The Pawnbroker with Rod Steiger, and they had a scene with a woman's nude breast from the front shown. And of course, there was a violation of the code at the time, and they said this has to be done for artistic purposes. And I think no, actually, from an artistic standpoint, it's much more effective to see how to show the woman's bare back and show the man's reaction to her breast, as opposed to the other way around. Otherwise, you're titillating the audience. But they let it through because it was a Holocaust film. So the production code collapsed. And within a few years, within 6 years, you had Deep Throat being run at a mainline movie theater in New York City. That was Deep Throat. And so and then
it was all downhill from – yeah, I was going to say it's all downhill from there.
But they were trying to break the production. They couldn't. A lot of other things going on at the time with the creation of suburbia, the destruction of the Catholic neighborhoods, and with that, the destruction or reduction of Catholic cultural power and its ability to restrain the Jews of Hollywood, which they did for 30, 35 years with Joe Breen. It was Joe Breen who ran the the production code with the Legion of Decency, which was a Catholic organization backing it up. And that power was based on the fact that the Catholic Church could declare a boycott and the Catholics in these ethnic neighborhoods would follow the bishop's orders. And so Hollywood produced films that the Catholic Church didn't like or found offensive. People would boycott the movies and they go bankrupt. And so this was an important check on Jewish power. And it's very undemocratic in the sense – well, it's democratic in the sense that people agree with it. But I'm saying this shows you the power of sort of collective ethnic identity, checking another ethnic group, and how the atomization of white America, particularly the destruction of Catholic identity in the latter part of the – in the second part of the 20th century was a big part in the Cultural Revolution and Jewish ascendancy in the United States. And again, a lot of this suburbia, consumerism, all that, and also – well, the force multiplier, of course, was television, electronic media, and these things, which were dominated, like Hollywood, dominated by Jews. It was the Catholic priest, Father Feeney, in the 1950s that said having a TV in your living room was like having a Jew in your living room. That's a bad idea. But it was that type of ethnic identity, that type of dialogue, which is what you need. We need today. So this frank dialogue. Let's cut the crap.
Absolutely.
You're Jewish. I know what you're up to. Okay, we'll let you have your life, but not let you dominate and corrupt everybody. Which
right.
Like, it was Joe. This is what Joe Breen said about Hollywood. This was in the 1930s. He goes, "There are simply a rotten bunch of vile people with no respect for anything beyond making of money. Here in Hollywood, we have paganism rampant in its most virulent form. Drunkenness, debauchery are commonplace. Sexual perversion is rampant. Any number of our directors and stars are perverts. The Jews seem to think of nothing but money making and sexual indulgence. The vilest kind of sin is a common indulgence hereabouts, and the men and women who engage in this sort of business are the men and women who decide what the film fair of the nation is to be. They alone make the decision. 95% of these folks are Jews of Eastern European lineage. They are probably the scum of the earth."
Well said, that man.
Yes. It was that sort of street smart understanding of Jews is what's needed today. The problem is, because of the narrative, the Holocaust narrative, if you speak so negatively of Jewish power and critique it, you are accused of being a Nazi and bringing on a second Holocaust.
Exactly. Well, yeah, so I take it you probably agree more or less with my assessment that it is like the central narrative.
It's the founding
is
the basis for the American Empire and the basis for the Jewish takeover of the American Empire. There was a recent piece, which is key because before that it was kind of waspy. America's history, ethnic history, is sort of ethnic warfare is basically it's Jew, WASP, and Catholic. And with the Jews sort of playing second fiddle to the WASP, but then slowly taking over in the 20th century. And that's probably the most important event, unreported event of the past 7,500 years is the Jewish takeover of American culture and also the American Empire. There was a piece that I ran across by Jung Freud. I guess that's a pen name, but he writes for the UNS Review. And he talked about this in one of his pieces, and I thought it was pretty good. Want me to quote from it?
Yeah, sure. I saw it come out. I didn't actually read it, though, yet.
Yeah, and this he goes, I don't agree with everything he says. He actually believes in the Holocaust, the basic Holocaust story, from what I gather in his readings. But he does.
Oh no.
He takes a nuanced approach to it. But anyway, whatever. He goes, indeed, even without being anti-Jewish, one could change the political discourse by focusing attention on what may be the biggest stealth revolution since the end of World War II. The end of the Cold War and the rise of China pale in significance to the Jews replaced the WASP as the ruling leader of the United States. The stealth revolution was so big and so profoundly consequential on the global scale, but there has hardly been a book written on it. The ethno-power revolution took place in what soon became the lone superpower with the demise of the Soviet behemoth. It was the death knell of the old America and the Frankenstein conception of a new one. It meant a wholesale reordering of culture, foreign policy, and values. One cannot understand the logic of systemic racism, of global homo celebration, wars in the Middle East, anti-Russian hysteria without addressing the Jewish factor predicated on it's good for Zion. Jews vilify white racism. white privilege to prevent non-whites and idiot whites from noticing that it's the Jews who hold supremacist power in the United States. Jews are nervous about people discussing the ethno-elite revolution of Jews, replacing Anglo-Americans as top dogs, even when the Joe Biden fulsomely praised Jewish domination of media entertainment for spreading global homo and gay marriage. Jews are hush-hush about it. It suggests that even positive and flattering commentary on the Jewish takeover of the U.S. is threatening to Jewish power. At the very moment, it can spread consciousness that Jews do control America, thereby the West. That way, people may be more privy as to why certain trends are favored, certain events are nudged to happen, and certain views are suppressed. There is a Jewish hand behind it, whether good or bad. Even in praise, recognition of Jewish dominance eventually means more scrutiny, criticism, as democracy means the people speaking truth to power. The Jewish takeover of power in the U.S. in praise or condemnation, needs to be a major subject of history, discussion, polemics, criticism. At the very least, people will know who the real boss is in the United States.
Yeah, very well said.
And I think
I'm going to have to read that article. But yeah, I think the national strategy
to combat anti-Semitism or counter anti-Semitism is proof of that supremacy.
Right. Oh, it absolutely is. Well, so this gets back to, I guess, more of a fundamental, like basic, like how do we understand the whole Jewish question? And I mean, I mentioned Hitler earlier, and like I don't know if you know, but like I read Mein Kampf and I was just like blown away, like, wow, this guy really had a lot of things figured out. He seems to be a very righteous, or seemed to be a very righteous, like honorable person that just did everything in his power to uplift his nation and really did a lot of good and very insightful on a lot of issues. And he wrote in that book, one of the biggest lies was that the Jews were a mere religious minority, when in reality they were a very hostile foreign, like alien ethnic mm-hmm. or racial group operating in society. And I think that that's absolutely right. Now, I know you're like basically a traditional Catholic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and so am I. And like it's one of those things that like I think the traditional approach to Jews from the Catholic Church was they need to be converted, they need to repent and accept Jesus and this sort of thing. When I think that's sort of a flawed understanding of the problem because they're just like a different group of people.
Yeah,
and,
it was,
and that's
secret,
never
secret
really
Judaism non. It was the secret Judaism non was the principle. Basically, the Jews should go unmolested, but the Jews cannot corrupt the host culture.
Okay, so and this, okay, of course, so it wasn't actually advocating their conversion. Well,
I mean, every Good Friday, there's a parade of conversion of the Jews.
Oh, okay, okay.
You know, and so that was the thing. You convert. Of course, that was the chief mission of the Catholic Church, was for all nations, including the Jews. And the first conversion occurred when I think Saint Peter comes out and he says, "You killed Christ. You're the enemies of mankind." And it cuts him to the heart. And many converted, many didn't. And so is that frank – the language that you need to have with the Jews or something like Joe Breen, you need to talk to them in those frank terms to, you know, tell them what the score is. And they'll basically indicate that we have their number. Nevertheless, we love you. Convert. And
that's kind of like the – like what I'm getting at here is like can that genuinely happen? Can Jews renounce Judaism and, you know, quote unquote renounce Judaism or whatever and – convert to Catholicism or to Christianity? Because we see, like, for example, with Vatican II, the which was like a total undermining of the Catholic Church, by the way, I'm sure you're aware of that. And some of the leading people involved in that were converso Jews. And Jews openly write about this and write entire books about the subject, by the way. And mm-hmm. I guess what I'm getting at, is it simply a religious thing or is it a racial, ethnic, maybe genetic component to all of this? Because I tend to agree with Hitler that this is absolutely a racial, ethnic, you know, component here. It's not simply a religious dispute. Like the Jews are like, you know, white or something, and they just practice a different religion.
I mean, ethnic. I mean, the rejection of Christ was basically ethnic pride, meaning Christ came to redeem all mankind, which meant that the Jews, the chosen people, were now obsolete. They didn't want to give up their chosenness, if you will. And he conflicted with their vision of things, which is, you know, sort of a messiah, military, political messiah. And basically, Christ said, well, you know, your time is now over. I've come for all people. And they weren't willing to do that. So they conspired in murdering Jesus Christ with the Romans. And so ultimately, their ethnic pride was their downfall. It's also the source of the fact that they became, according to the Gospel of St. John, the enemies of mankind. If indeed you're against Christ, the Logos, the meaning of the universe, you're against humanity. You're the enemy. And to the extent that you lead humanity away from that, you're the enemy of mankind. Nevertheless, there is redemption and conversion and salvation. You can't have, and there have been many examples throughout history of genuine conversion. And personally, I know a few cases where people, Jews who are Catholic, and you don't get the sense that they're revolutionary Jews at all. There are a lot of Jews who convert to Catholicism and still say, well, I'm Jewish. And yeah, that's that old converso issue. And like, that was the problem in Spain in the 15th century, was you had this massive conversion. In fact, it was too successful. They had so many false converts, and they had infiltrated the church, infiltrated the Spanish government, which is why they were expelled in 1492, along with the remaining Muslims. And this is why you had the Inquisition and these things. You had to investigate. And of course, again, this goes to what was the conception of the state back then. You had confessional states back then. In order to be Spanish, you had to be Catholic. That's just the way it was. And so this is why. And so if you didn't confess to the faith of the state of the nation, you weren't a citizen. And either you were barred from institutions or having any meaningful political power or trades or whatever, or you had to leave. It's just the way it was thought of back then. This is why the principle of sacred days non was functional, because that's functional in a confessional state. What happened with Europe and, you know, the wake of the French Revolution, the Napoleonic Wars, you had the collapse of the confessional state and the rise of liberal states, and this myth of liberalism where people could be citizens based on certain ideals, you know, propositions, if you will, where all ethnic groups, all people could be citizens. And when, in the wake of Napoleon, you had Jewish emancipation in Europe, which did away with these barriers that protected these Christian societies from the Jews. But the idea was Jews would just become normal citizens at the time. They didn't, of course. And they certain elite Jews, a good example would be like the Rothschilds, were able to inveigle themselves and scheme and gain a certain amount of financial power that they turned into political power. And by the end of the 19th century, the British Empire was more or less a subsidiary of Rothschild banking interest, which is why it's very hard when you're looking at Western history, at least the way I read it. I'm willing to be, you know, to be corrected, but I look at it in the 19th and early 20th century, you had the takeover of the West by a Jewish elite, and with financing in league with the WASPs, like the Rockefeller, these monopolists and these things. And for the long, you know, for several decades, the WASPs were ascendant in power, and the Jews were the junior partner. But again, after the Second World War, you had sort of a changing of the guard, a circulation of elites, if you will, particularly after 1967. When through the 60s and 70s, you had the ascendancy of Jewish power, and it was solidified by the 1980s in the Reagan administration.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of
ethical. I remember
analysis.
Reading.
So, you know.
Yeah.
Again, a lot of people think if you look at it that way, you're being anti-Semitic. A lot of people look at like the British Empire, and they think of like Cecil Rhodes and the Rhodes Trust, Oxford. It's a British Empire. It is British descent that is British, but Britain had been taken over by Rothschild in the 19th century.
Yeah, Well, and not only Rothschild, but who is it? Montague and was it Sassoon?
Yes, Sassoon.
I mean, there was a lot of Jews involved in it. I remember reading a book. Gosh, I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it was basically a history of the British aristocracy and how like all of the big time aristocrats like married into Jewish or Jews married into their family.
Yeah, they bought peerages.
And this was right. Yeah, and it was like a total corruption of it. Yeah,
this was a function of usury, and it also usually factors into the Irish potato famine, because there was the interest payments that had to be made by the British elite, the aristocracy. it compelled them to export food from Ireland to maintain those payments. What happened was in the 18th, 19th century, particularly the 19th century, you had a lot of British aristocracy, a lot of land that had been stolen from the church for centuries in the wake of the, you know, the English Reformation. And so, but they wanted to, with the peak of the British Empire in the 19th century, largely through the sale of opium, through Sassoons and Rothschild, and that was sort of the development of modern banking, the Bank of England and international finance was the drug trade. Also the rise of intelligence agencies. We still see that today. But the British aristocracy wanted to build these huge manor homes that we all know. You know, we see, you know, like we see like in the Tarzan movies and all that, with he's a descendant of a large landed aristocracy. But the landed aristocracy came into power by stealing land from the Catholic Church under Henry VIII during the Reformation. But they had a lot of land, but very little cash. So they borrowed money from like Rothschild and other Jewish bankers and went into hock for it in a heavy debt. And the Jews used that financial leverage to kind of buy their way into the British establishment, do away with, again, with laws preventing Jews from being members of parliament in the 19th century. A lot of, and so what happened was you had this slow, sort of the integration of Jews into the English aristocracy because of debt and usury.
Right.
And
well, and not again, only the integration, now, but they took it over.
Jewish power, when we're talking about Jewish power, is it's very easy us to blame the Jews, but the other part of that, the takes two to tango, is the greed of the Goyim, of wanting to live beyond their means, you know,
right.
It's the same way.
Yeah,
their power derives from our weakness, our sinfulness. And so we have to be willing to address the fact that the weakness, you know, whether it be the Christian or you know, the Goyim, if you will, it's their own weakness that allows this to happen. Live
it's,
beyond
it's
means.
It's their own sins that allow this to happen. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the whole, that's like one of the main lessons of the Bible. Yeah, absolutely. I
like Rothschild, like the Churcher family was heavily in debt in the Rothschild. Randolph died like 60 pounds in debt to Natty Rothschild. And Churchill himself was bailed out by Jewish financiers in the 1930s. Just at the time he turned against Hitler, by the way, in his political rhetoric. You know, he'd been built.
Imagine that. What a coincidence.
And, of course, we forget that the Balfour Declaration was written to Lord Rothschild.
Yep.
And the Balfour Declaration is a promise of the British Empire to give Palestine to the Jews should Jews in America leverage their power to get the United States into the war on the behalf of the British Empire, which was at that time losing the war to Germany. And that's when Jews turned against Germany. Because the Jews at that time hated Russia, Jews in America, they hated Russia, and they were primarily more pro-German. But the moment the Balfour Declaration came in, they switched on a dime and started backing the United States against scheming to get the United States into the war against Germany. And this was done through sexual blackmail of Woodrow Wilson, Senator Untermeyer and Bernard Baruch. And these financiers,
his handlers,
yes,
yeah,
and of course, he was the one that appointed the first Jewish Supreme Court justice, who was also a Jewish Zionist agent,
Brandeis, yeah, exactly.
He was, again, so the very here's the thing: people say we shouldn't appoint a Jew to the Supreme Court because we can't be trusted. Well, that's anti-Semitic, that's racist, nativist, that's primitive, but then again, it turns out that Brandeis was a Zionist agent.
Exactly. I know, exactly.
You know, so, okay, I mean, I'm thinking, okay. And his protege, Felix Frankfurter, same thing.
Well, Tim, thanks a lot, man. This has been great. This has been a great conversation. We could probably go on and on about this,
yes.
But I know it's getting late, and I think we covered the topic pretty extensively.
Great.
Made the points. Yeah, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it. I will definitely send you a link once this is up. And keep up the good work. I will definitely stay in touch, and we'll do this again in the future.
Excellent. Good night, then.
Okay. Good night, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye.